Welcome back. You're listening to Becoming Americans, part two of A Journey Through the Jewish Lower East Side of New York, part of the series Only in America, 350 Years of the American Jewish Experience. I'm Larry Josephson. A cornucopia of Yiddish culture flourished on the Lower East Side. Newspapers, theater, movies, music, and radio.
WVFW, you are listening to the first station on your dial.
WBBC, New York.
When radio became popular in the 1920s, the world of Yiddish was not going to be denied. Probably the most important station was WEVD.
WEVD, New York.
Which was created by the Furwitz Association. That's the same association that published the Yiddish Daily Forward. And it was named in honor of Eugene V. Debs, a leader of the Socialist Party in the United States. He ran a number of times for president, most successfully in 1912. WEVD was a socialist station in the 1920s. Later, it became less ideological, but it used to call itself the station that speaks your language.
M'lady, leap, m'lady, zee hop, na leap, m'lady, m'lady, frozen food products for you.
I was the staff announcer there after college in the early 60s.
Isaiah Sheffer, artistic director of Symphony Space.
I was doing the commercials for Mighty Fine Chocolate Pudding, and the ad agency guy gave me the copy. The commercials were done live. And one day the guy gave me the new copy, which announced that Mighty Fine wants you housewives to know that in addition to Mighty Fine Chocolate Pudding, Mighty Fine is announcing a new flavor, Mighty Fine Nut Chocolate Pudding. So go to your grocer and tell him you want to try the nut chocolate pudding.
Cheese blintzes, apple, cherry, blueberry, and strawberry. Dumplings and potato latkes too.
In the control room a few minutes later, the phone rings and my job was to answer it. And the lady says, "Tell me something, young man. What is the other flavor?" I said, "The other flavor is nut chocolate." "I know it's nut chocolate, but what is it? Is it a mystery flavor? What is the other flavor?" And this went on and on for some time, like who's on first. I attest that this actually happened.
Barbasol, Barbasol, ihr darf dem Röschchen safe mitnehmen, schäft zur Wiffen sich allein. Barbasol, Barbasol, ah, Barbasol.
My uncle, whose name was V. Schuller, was a fairly well-known star of the Yiddish theater, as well as of Yiddish radio. From time to time, I'd come home from school, and there would have been a phone call that they need a kid, they need a boy for this or that show. And bingo, I was in rehearsal. So I started at the age of 7, 1943, 44, in Maury Schwartz's Yiddish Art Theater, in his production of the original Tevye, years before it became transmogrified into Fiddler on the Roof.
Yiddish theater was in a very important part of life on the Lower East Side.
People were coming to the Yiddish theater after long days at work.
Zalman Milotek, director of the Volksbühne Yiddish Theater.
They would save up their money, their pennies, because they got to see their lives. There's a wonderful song called Muttel the Operator, Muttel the Sewing Machine Operator.
Muttel der Operator, in the shop dort ständig in alle Jugendgäter in dem Strand.
Basically talks about Muttel working in a sweatshop and being a good union man and being assaulted by bosses and dying for trying to make a living for his wife and kids. There were shows and plays about revolution, and the Artef Theater, which was the left-wing Yiddish theater, was very much active with that, and of course the Volksbühne, which I run today, produced many shows with social significance. Volksbühne means people's stage. And this was an organization created by people who came to the Workman's Circle, the fraternal organization that was formed to aid immigrant workers, came together and said, we want to create a theater that will be an alternative to the Second Avenue schmaltz and do performances of our Yiddish, great Yiddish writers. The heyday of the Yiddish theater was the turn of the century up to the 20s.
Whenever there was money, we went to Second Avenue. My father was a big theater buff. He always took the children. Lined us up when it was time to go to the theater, pish to chais. We all had to, you know, go to the bathroom, pish to chais. We went to the theater. We saw everything. We saw Morris, Karnofsky.
My husband, Pesach Burstein, was brought to this country in 1923 by Boris Tomaszewski. His forte was whistling. He used to sing, dance, and whistle.
They say in the year 1900 alone, over 2 million people went to the Yiddish theater. The Yiddish theater comes from the idea of the Purim Spiel. During the holiday of Purim, people would come together and create shows that depicted the story of Purim. And from that came the depiction of stories of the Joseph tale and the Abraham and Sarah tale. And these stories became the basis of the Yiddish theater.
Isaiah Sheffer.
Abraham Goldfaden is generally credited as being the father of the Yiddish theater. It begins in that legendary wine cellar in Yass, Romania.
There were itinerant singers. They were called the Brudersinger, the singers from the town of Brud. And these singers would recite poems depicting Jewish life. And it was Abraham Goldfaden who found his way into one of these wine cellars in Romania and started to create these kind of songs. And it was his plays that started in 1876 in Romania. He has a play, one of his famous plays called Bar Kokhba, who was the hero who led the Jewish uprising against the Romans. And this led to the banning of Yiddish theater in Russia because the Tsar and his censors felt that it was a veiled attempt for a revolution.
It took the combination of this notion of Yiddish theater and the freedom of American soil to make it really flourish.
The first show in America was in 1882, and it was called The Sorcerer, The Witch. And it was a show, actually, that Boris Tomaszewski produced, written by Abraham Goldfaden. This was the living soap opera of the day. So people came there and they came with families. They came with their kids.
I was very small, maybe 4 years old. They used to take me to Tomaszewski's theater, was on the Bowery. You didn't have a babysitter or anyone. Wherever you went, you took your kid.
The people used to play along with the audience. And most of the plays had to have that good boy, that lover, and the villain. The villain had to come in with striped pants. The minute he entered, the people went, boo, boo. naturally, at the end of the scene, either they shot the villain or he got run over by a car. So it ended with a party, you know. Everybody sings L'chaim, L'chaim, L'mirzaim Freilich.
The Adler family were the kings and queens of my mother's generation, the great Jacob Adler, pater familias.
Lula Adler Rosenfeld is one of Jacob Adler's granddaughters.
He went to Washington and he saw President Taft. And the president said, "Mr. Adler, why do you put your children on the stage?" And he said, "Well, how else will I know where they are?"
It was a constant give and take from the audience to the stage.
Ihr reist nicht hier ab hierher in den weltberühmten Schreiber Shakespeare.
One of the famous stories is when they're doing King Lear, Kenig Lear. And, of course, King Lear deals with a tragic story between the father and his daughters, and he's bemoaning how his daughters are treating him.
Oh, the kinder, the kinder.
And you had an audience member crying out, "Mr. Adler, Mr. Adler, come home with me, I'll make you a chicken soup."
He kneels, then Pitzter, der Edischer Kenig Lear.
Boris Tomaszewski starred in a Jewish version of Romeo and Juliet. And a marquee was put on the theater, and it said in Yiddish, "Romeo und Juliet, or Juliet, by William Shakespeare." And then in much bigger letters, it said, "Ausgebessert by Jacob Gordon." Ausgebessert means improved. It created a sensation, and one of the sweatshop workers sitting in the front row yelled for the author, whereupon Boris Tomaszewski came on stage and said he was very sorry, but that Mr. Shakespeare was indisposed that evening.
Everything was offered from Shakespeare to Molière to the vaudeville theaters to the melodramas of the day. The Schund plays, the trashy plays, plays like Von Glück bis Strick, From Happiness to the Gallows, a melodrama in three acts, you know, or A Mutter's Heart, A Mother's Heart, another melodrama in four acts.
Isaiah Sheffer.
My perspective as the kid was that I often had roles that exemplified the conflict between the immigrant generation and the first offspring trying to fit into America. I'd play the kid who wants to talk English and who wants to go to public school and fit in with everybody else on the Lower East Side. And I had lines like, "Oh, Ma, you don't understand."
So we have the balance between the serious and the popular. This was their way of connecting with their old home and assimilating into this country.
Molly Pekin. Oh, she was marvelous. She could do anything. She was an actress. She would sing. She would dance. She would. She turned somersaults. She did everything. She was little. She was only about 5 feet tall. She was marvelous.
Hot dogs! So then I'm hot dogs! They ran on hot dogs! This ain't the hit!
Mama decided I could be an actress. I sang and danced and turned somersaults and what have you.
Molly Pekin.
And so she made me a fancy little dress and we went on a trolley car to the Bijou Theater. Well, on the trolley car there was a drunk and he looked at me and I was all dressed up fancy, you know, and he said, "What are you doing in that fancy little dress?" And I said, "I was an actor and I was going to the Bijou, to the amateur night to win the first prize." And he said, "Nah, you're not an actor. You'll never win anything." So Mama said, "Molly, show him." So I got up on the trolley car and did my act. And the drunk passed around a hat and collected about $2 in coins and gave them to me. And then Mama took me to the Bijou, and I won the first prize at the amateur night. From that day on, I have been working all my life, on an average 45 weeks a year at least.
What was an interesting theme was the love of America.
causing that scene.
Very often, no matter what the show was, somehow an American twist would come into it. Sometimes a show would end with a tribute to the American flag all of a sudden. There were songs like Hurrah for Uncle Sam, Lebensol Columbus, Long Live Columbus.
Historian Annie Poland.
The Yiddish Theater was open every day of the week, including Friday night, and they really shouldn't have been there. On the Sabbath, you know, if they were Orthodox Jews, they should not have been in the theater on a Friday night.
The pious Jews were against the theater from the very beginning. They tried to stop it. They went to the authorities and stopped it. They went to the Goyim to stop it. The pious Jew finally went to the theater on Friday night, too. Friday night was a big night in the Yiddish theater.
There's a wonderful anecdote by Hutchin Hapgood, who was a non-Jewish, a progressive writer who came in and wrote a series of sketches on the Lower East Side. And he wrote about how on a Friday night, an actor on the stage was smoking a cigar.
The actor, who through the exigencies of his role is compelled to appear on Friday night with a cigar in his mouth, is frequently greeted with hisses and strenuous cries of shame, shame, smoke on the Sabbath from the proletarian hypocrites in the gallery. Hutchins Hapgood, The Spirit of the Ghetto, 1902.
For many of these people, life was so turned upside down that their going to the Yiddish theater was not a statement to say, I'm not religious anymore. It was just, how do we make all these choices in the urban life that we now lead?
Wenn die host a narischen Schmechel, wenn die host weißus Sechel, wenn die bist wild van Indiane, bist a viele Galiziane, so gich du sat mich nicht.
The joke used to be, listen, you'll get rid of that accent, you'll work uptown. And many people did get rid of that accent and did work uptown. Other great talents never quite broke away enough.
In terms of the Yiddish theater as a central place for entertainment, well, you know, Hollywood happened, Broadway happened.
By mir bist du schön, by mir hast du kein.
People wanted to see things in English.
By me, Mr. Shane, please let me explain. By me, Mr. Shane, means your brain.
1909. Dear Mr. Editor, when I came to America, I developed spiritually and became a free thinker. But the nature of my feelings is remarkable. Listen to me. Every year, when the time of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur approaches, my heart grows heavy and sad, and I decide to go to the synagogue. I go not to pray to God, but to heal and refresh my aching soul with the cantor's sweet melodies, and this had an unusually good effect on me. I am a member of a progressive society, and since I am known as an outspoken free thinker, they began to criticize me for going to the synagogue.
My father was extremely religious, and he was also very, very radical. I remember as children, one day we would go collecting money for the Jewish National Fund, and another time we'd go collecting for Sacco and Vanzetti. It was a peculiar, looking back on, a very peculiar relationship of extreme religion and extreme radical activity.
In the early years of socialism in America and anarchism among the East European immigrants, they did all they could to distance themselves from the religious. For example, the anarchists would have parties called the Yom Kippur balls. They would meet on the eve of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar, and simply have parties, have speakers, and sometimes they would be costume parties. And what these show in many ways is how important religion was to the daily life of the immigrants, in that that was how you had to rebel. You still had to rebel according to the Jewish calendar.
I have never forgotten the impression of my first Saturday in Boston. I compared it to the Sabbath in Slutsk. For Slutsk, though poverty-stricken, dressed up in glorious raiment in honor of the Sabbath. But in Boston, very few Jews observe the Sabbath. Leaving the synagogue after the Sabbath Eve service, the observants were confronted by a tumultuous Jewish quarter. Shopkeepers stood in shop doorways. Peddlers on their wagons shouted their wares. Mournfully, I passed through the Jewish quarter that first Sabbath Eve. As I entered our house, it seemed to me that the Sabbath candles were bowed in mourning. Ephraim Lisitsky in the grip of cross currents.
Religiosity was a great luxury. To not work on the Sabbath might be the difference between survival and failure.
From what I had seen of the world or read about in the daily press, I was convinced that few people of wealth and power had real religion in their hearts. I felt sure that most of them looked up on churches or synagogues as they did upon police courts, that they valued them primarily as safeguards of law and order and correctness, and this had become my attitude. The Rise of David Levinsky by Abraham Kahan, 1917.
Abraham Kahan wrote The Rise of David Levinsky. It was about an immigrant who comes to America and starts out in a factory and then works up to own his own factory.
Levinsky, in fulfilling this American dream and rising to the top, moving into fancy circles in the fine Hebrew homes of Harlem, he falls prey to the competitiveness of American business and the way in which he has to screw the laborers who are working for him, and shifty business tactics.
The idea is that in achieving American material success, he loses his spirituality, he loses his individuality.
He doesn't end up in the novel a happy man.
I was born and reared in the lower depths of poverty, and I arrived in America in 1885 with 4 cents in my pocket. I am now worth more than $2 million and recognized as one of the 2 or 3 leading men in the cloak and suit trade in the United States. And yet, when I take a look at my inner identity, it impresses me as being precisely the same as it was 30 or 40 years ago. My present station, power, the amount of worldly happiness at my command, and the rest of it seem to be devoid of significance.
It's a classic American story of what profiteth a man if he gain the whole world, if he loseth his own soul.
They said that in general, the typical time period that it took to get from Hester Street to Lexington Avenue was 7 years.
In a single generation, this could be done. You could rise from being a sweatshop worker to what they would call, in English, a cloak and suit manufacturer. And you could rise within 10 years, if you played your cards right, from Rivington Street to Riverside Drive.
But of course, there were many people who never made it.
One of the great tragedies of history is that the lives of the failures are really not well known because they leave very few records. Evictions was a big problem.
I remember when you couldn't pay your rent, they would dispossess you, and you saw people, and they would sit there with a cup and lose 12 pennies.
Very often people moved in the middle of the night to somewhere else to get away from paying the rent. Always left behind the piano. A piano was always left behind. Huge upright pianos because they couldn't move it and they just left it there.
There were certainly many people who just never made it out and were not part of this overall success story that we're used to hearing. And often they stayed on the Lower East Side. Sometimes their kids did better and their kids moved on.
They moved up and out of the Lower East Side into Harlem, the Bronx, and the suburbs. Starting in 1921, Congress made it much harder for new immigrants to enter the country by passing a series of laws that restricted immigration through quotas based on national origin.
The anti-immigrant sentiment is part of a desire to keep America white and Anglo-Saxon and largely Protestant. It's directed especially at immigrant Jews and immigrant Catholics from countries such as Italy or Poland. And this remains law through World War II. Revisions aren't made until the 1950s.
These laws were devastating to Jews seeking refuge from the Nazis in the late 30s and 40s. By then, Yiddish culture on the Lower East Side was slowly dying, legally by exclusion, culturally through assimilation, and literally through extermination. The Lower East Side has continued to be a neighborhood of immigrants.
A lot of things are going on the Lower East Side. On the one hand, there is gentrification.
Big apartment is daddy.
Daddy and mommy pay for the big apartment that's very expensive, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we were surprised it was so expensive on Orchard Street.
Yeah.
This building used to be the fabric store. So he sold the building and he moved to the other place. His name is Greenberg. People say it was here, all Jewish people, and the business was so good.
It's still a vibrant immigrant neighborhood. It's a Chinese neighborhood. It is a Puerto Rican neighborhood, a Dominican neighborhood. So in many ways, what happened 100 years ago with the Jewish immigrants is going on right now with the immigrants today and their children.
You've been listening to Becoming Americans, the second of a two-part journey through the Jewish Lower East Side of New York. Part of the series, Only in America, 350 Years of the American Jewish Experience. We've heard excerpts of oral histories from people who lived on the Lower East Side at the turn of the 20th century. Our readers were Jerry Stiller, Barbara Rosenblatt, Isaiah Sheffer, Oliver Wyman, Stacy Brass, and Zero Mostel, whose performance was used by permission of the estate of Zero Mostel. Robert Pinsky read his poem, Shirt. To hear this program or others in the series, and for information about podcasts, CDs, and transcripts, visit our website, onlyinamerica.info. Send your comments to only@radioart.org. The series was developed, written, and executive produced by Larry Josephson for the Radio Foundation. This program was produced by Larry Josephson, Sarah Elzis, and Sarah Parath. It was edited by Sarah Elzis. Our script consultant is Paul Fisher. Marty Goldenson is our resident radio doctor. We had help from Sarah Kramer, Adam Goodkind, Franny Carr, Eleanor Ostrinsky, Rosa Goldenson, Maisie Tivnan, Raylan Grogan, and Diana Green. Our historical consultant is Dr. Jonathan Sarna. The interviews were recorded by Bill Sigmund and Robert Ault. Post-production by David Rapkin and Robert Ault. A very special thanks to Nikki Newman Tanner. Thanks also to the Ellis Island Oral History Collection, the Tamamit Library at NYU, the Pittsburgh Jewish Oral History Project, the Doro Jewish Division, and the Performing Arts Division of the New York Public Library, the Judaica Sound Archives at Florida Atlantic University Libraries, the Unite Here Archives at Cornell University, YIVO, the Eldridge Street Synagogue Project, and the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. Thanks also to Bob Gill, who designed our logo, to Joan Franklin at Cinema Sound, Rich Conaty of WFUV's The Big Broadcast, to my assistant, Deborah Sithopoulos, and to Andy Lancet, who runs the WNYC Archives. This series was funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. Additional funds from Saul and Stanley Zabar in memory of their parents, Louis and Lillian Zabar, Russian immigrants who founded Zabar's more than 70 years ago. Zabar's, a New York landmark, supplies food and delicacies to New Yorkers and to the nation. On the web at zabars.com. Additional support from Edwin A. Goodman, Harvey and Thelma Reisman, the John L. Loeb Jr. Foundation, from Frost, Zelnick, Lehrman, and Zissou, specializing in intellectual property law for clients worldwide, on the web at frostzelnick.com, and from one anonymous donor. This is Larry Josephson.
Mazel tov, mazel tov.
This program is distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.